Welcome, Tim, to Sweeney versus Bird. Okay, welcome to this ongoing conversation. Maybe you could just introduce yourself. You know, tell us where you are, what you're doing. You know, what's going on with you.
Well, I'll start by giving you my Vajrayana given name from Lama Ole Nidal, which is Sering Dorje, powerful life, Dorje.
Powerful life, cool. Do I have to give you my Buddhist name as well? Is that what? And then was there,
of
then,
course,
our Zender can give his.
Okay, this is the thing. We've known Tim from the Intellectual Deep now for several years, and this is the first time Tim Pickerel is actually a guest on Sweeney versus Bard. I've been waiting for this conversation for such a long time. We can do so many different types of conversation about art and music and tons of shit. But what really thrills me is that as a Zoroastrian, you guys are both Vajrayana Buddhists, and I want to figure out and find out everything about Vajrayana Buddhism through these different two parallaxes called Tim and Andrew tonight, whatever your Buddhist names are. But go ahead.
Okay,
Andrew,
okay.
What's your fucking religious name? What's your Buddhist
name? Yeah, mine is Manjushri. It means Jamyang Gyatso. It means ocean of wisdom. There you go. But and I got my name back way back in the 90s. The Buddhists tend to give you a lot of names. I've got like three different names from three different lineages. But anyway, I won't go into all that. But I won't, because we want to hear from you a bit. So, Lama Ole,
how
do you lineage?
90s. I was in San Francisco, hanging out with a Gelugpa monk from Japan, and he influenced me a bit in looking towards Buddhism. I was heavy into Gurdjieff and Hermeticism, and was in the art world there, Burning Man, all of that, and was getting tired of San Francisco. A lot of people, everyone that had moved there in the late 80s and early 90s from all over America, were leaving again back to various places. And my gallerist moved to, we were living in a Hungarian house, and he went to Budapest, and I followed him to go and make art and hang out for 6 months or stay forever, and ended up meeting Lama Ole Nidal through a mutual friend, an art friend, Juju Koshegi.
Hey, can you just tell us who Lama Ole is? I'm going to make a few parentheses and then we'll go back to your story. But for the people who are watching this podcast, they need to know who Lama Ole is. He's originally Norwegian or Danish, right?
He's a Dane.
He's a Dane.
And him and his wife, Hana, they were classic 60s folk. They were doing LSD and smoking weed and traveling the Silk Road, literally, you know, doing their business dealings between the hippies and India. And
he was a boxer too, though, wasn't he?
He was a boxer. He was a motorcycle rider. You know, got a very intelligent wild man, and ended up running into the 16th Karmapa on retreat up on a mountain, and just fell under the power field of the Karmapa and transformed from there. There was still a lot of hippie action going on, all the, you know, LSD and hash and all of that. But gradually, through various troubles and insights, became fully invested in bringing Vajrayana to the West. per the Karmapa's request, you know, start setting up centers.
So and we have we have hundreds of centers now in Europe and North America.
All over the world, actually.
Usually called the Diamond Way. Yeah, Australia. Everywhere. It's everywhere, yeah. And so Lama Ola was instrumental in bringing, he was one of the guys, there were, of course, Tibetans doing it too, but he's one of the guys bringing Buddhism to the West, certainly. And when I've been meditating in Bavaria, for example, at the center called the Karma Kogyu, I think Lama Ola was instrumental in setting that up. I don't know.
Europe Center.
The Europe Center, exactly. So
he okays everything. Everything goes through him.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I can tell you a story about meeting him if you want. My story about meeting him. He was I was a student of Chogyam Trungpa, and Trungpa and his lineage were kind of at loggerheads. I don't know if he actually was in conflict with Trungpa, but he was more in conflict with Trungpa's heirs. In any case,
so we should just remind viewers here that Chogyam Trungpa was a Tibetan guy and a genius who became an alcoholic and died young, as tantric teachers should do. He was certainly crazy wisdom, but magnificent, and his books are just fucking brilliant.
Yeah. So, and these are
Chogyam
the two
Trungpa
guys,
or Lama Ola, is usually how you get connected to tantric Buddhism if you're a Westerner. So
these are the two guys who brought the Karmapa's teaching to the West, who brought you know, Kagyu Buddhism, even though Chogyam Trungpa was a Kagyu Nyingma teacher. We could talk about the Nyingma lineage. Also, this is an older lineage than Kagyu. In any case, I met him in Paris, and he was still with Hana. And I thought he was a fake. I thought he was a fake guru, and I thought he was kind of a, you know, but I went to a center, and there was all of these hot women everywhere, and I was single at the time, so I went to the center, and I actually met my wife at the Diamond Sangha Center, in Paris, and I went to see Lama Ole, and I had a big, like, I thought he was a big fake, and I thought he was racist, and I had all these ideas about him. Anyway, I went to see him.
Well, can I just ask you, Andrew? What did you think a guru was supposed to be at the time? Because obviously Westerners have never heard of crazy wisdom. They don't understand the concept.
The style of Shambhala was so different than his style. He had all these muscly guys like who look like Tim from the East, you know, from the Eastern Bloc. And they were all wearing T-shirts, and they were walking around like cool guys. And I thought they were kind of stupid. Whereas I guess the Shambhala community had more of American style, and they were kind of more sophisticated. They had a more sophisticated training program, and you know, there's all of this elaboration, so they were much more elaborate and sophisticated. So I thought that's the real deal, and these guys are kind of, it's a cult, right? Anyway,
isn't this funny? It's like the American version of what you're talking about here was like professional, subdued, you know, serious about his spirituality. And then you met the Tibetans, and they were running around with this fucking muscular bodyguard, the beautiful women around them. Isn't that exactly the wonderful thing about the dialectics involved here, that our perceptions are so dead wrong and the more or less the opposites? Was that your experience too, Tim, when you got...
Well, just let me finish my story here. So I ran into him in Paris, and he was with Hannah, and immediately I felt like I'm in a powerful, you know, space with this guy. And I said, okay, I was wrong. And then Hannah was so beautiful too. His wife was so incredibly beautiful. And then, so I asked him a question. I said, so how you guys keep it together? Because apparently he had lots of girlfriends. Like he had hundreds of girlfriends. I said, how you guys keep it together? How do you guys keep going? And then he said, he gave this long discourse, which was like the whole night. So my question was like, what he talked about like half the night was relationships and this and that. And I met him outside, and he grabbed me, and he grabbed my heart, and I felt this electricity. And he said your question really opened up people's heart. So from then on, I've always really loved Lama Ole. That's my story about him, even though
and
I'm
you,
not his.
And you, Tim, what's student. Your story with Lama Ole specifically?
And Andrew, what year was that?
Oh, it was 2004, probably.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I've just moved to France, maybe a couple years after I'd moved
to France. We'll go back to Gurdjieff later, because obviously we're all three obsessed with Gurdjieff. But Tim, go back to, you were Gurdjieff, and then you ran into Vajrayana Buddhism, and So back to your
in
story in
98,
Lamolden. 98. Yeah,
in
okay.
98, in Budapest, and Budapest is one of the strongest sanghas that there are. They have an absolutely amazing center that was getting built right around 2002, I think. But when I was there in 98, it was all just starting up. But the feeling of the Sangha was just overwhelming. It was so much fun. And the Hungarians, I traveled around with them all summer, going to the various retreats in Poland and in Hungary and in Germany and Austria. And it was just electric, especially with the Hungarians. And it was a funny dynamic between the Germans, who were very serious, and they would do their meditation, and then it would end, and they would be like, just, quiet and serious and respectful. And the Hungarians were immediately bursting into laughter and joking and carrying on. And, I fully bought into that and loved it and love it now, and started the work.
Yeah.
And this is something that,
We should talk about that, hey? The work, like what you have to do when you start becoming a Vajrayana practitioner, if we're going to talk about Vajrayana,
well, and I don't want to speak too out of place regarding other Vajrayana, but I think, and you can help me with this, I think there's a bit of a Vajrayana light of aesthetics, and yes, we meditate, and then there's Vajrayana of doing the work, of doing nundro.
Yeah,
And
Andrew.
nundro practices are the key, and that's what sets one Vajrayana practitioner apart from the rest, is doing that work. It's hard. 111,000 prostrations with the mentally taking refuge under the refuge tree, with all of that in your mind, the chanting and prostrating yourself. A full prostration, for everyone to understand, is going down on your belly, hands forward and then back up, and it's tough. And then you do 111,000 of Diamond Mind meditations, where you're doing a purification. I did actually did that ex I did an extended I did Diamond Mind for a long time. I needed quite a bit of purification. And the second part of it, I actually did Chud with, where you mentally dissect your body and feed it to the demons. And
So
then,
how did Nandra come about? How did the whole culture of Nandra develop?
well, that comes from Tilopa, is pass it on to Naropa. And then there's some questions as to whether or not Marpa got it directly from Naropa, but Marpa, the translator, took it into Tibet. And so that's 10th century, I think it is. And so that was the time of the Mahasiddhas and the crazy wisdom masters, not monks.
Yeah, not monks. Yeah, that's
These
that's
were
true.
we were outsiders. Milarepa, who was not a nice guy, and had to go through the alchemical process of transforming himself from someone who was base, who was cruel, who was mean, a murderer, into a diamond vehicle of higher mind, and went through. I think you could look at Marpa as much like Gurdjieff, of tearing people apart, not to bring them down, but to pull out from them who they really were, what the potential is in that person, which is very much key to Vajrayana thinking, that all is Buddha, all is Buddha field. You don't have to find it, you have to just recognize it. It's not something to go to, it's not outside of you, it's not something separate from yourself, it's your true nature, is how we put it.
And of course, the Western culture hasn't had any of these traditions, nothing even remotely similar. Yeah. I mean, to me, Freud and psychoanalysis is the beginning of a huge journey for the West to discover something similar. Because my experience with these spirituality was the same way. It's just like there was Buddhism, there was Taoism, there was Shaivism in India, and I eventually converted to Zoroastrianism, which is the Persian tradition related to the other three. And then, of course, I realized the separation of Tantra and Sutra, what it really means. And to do the work is to go into the tantric. And that's exactly why monasteries were built on mountains or faraway places, because you had to get away from absolutely everything to go into this kind of work. And obviously you two guys are both attracted to it, because obviously—
Well, I would say that the interesting thing about Vajrayana is the best place to do it would be like New York City, where Tim is, rather than on a mountain. Because, yes. You know, the most advanced place to do it would be in the middle of the chaos, not away from it. But everybody is different. And, you know, there are retreats, which is a big thing in the Vajrayana tradition. But I'd also add a couple things about Nundro.
My point is that the technique was developed in places that were mountains, not in New York City. Nobody sat at the center of a city and developed these fully hardcore kind of work methods with like thousands of hours being spent on finding these things you're looking for.
Well, the origin of Vajrayana is a lot of it is it comes from Bengal, and the Bengali tradition was very much on the Silk Road, so it was very cosmopolitan. And it was much less like Tibet. Tibet became very like a theocracy. So the wild characters that Tim is talking about, who became the center of the tradition, you know, it became very monastic and hierarchical and very sutric, actually, Tibet. And the wild yogis were kind of on the edges. But most of the Vajrayana, most people don't know this who study Tibetan Buddhism, but most of the Vajrayana traditions come from Bengal and prostrations, for example. They were systematized in Tibet. By various people. So the Nundro that Tim's talking about is like 100,000 prostrations, 100,000, this purification mantras. Then you do, then you make offerings of mandalas, which are, you know, you're giving away everything. And then, you know, after you give away everything, you know, then you make a relationship with the master, with the teacher. So this is the essence really of doing Nundro is, getting to have the relationship with the guru, actually, with the teacher. And that tradition predates Tibet. In fact, most of the Vajrayana lineages predate Tibet. There's only a few of them, like the Machilodrik lineage, that was actually developed in Tibet, even though Tibet had an amazing syncretic tradition.
We should add here that the screaming kid in the background is not Andrew's kid at all. It's an added sound we've added to add a certain crazy wisdom vibe to the whole conversation. Exactly. So now you know you can really be relaxed about it. So that was the point. No, don't worry, Andrew. It's funny.
Let me touch on two points. That was what is going on? Balloons everywhere. Two points. There was a kernel of Tantra transformation in alchemy. It's hard to say what they were really thinking, because it's couched in chemistry, right? All this lore around that of trying to create gold, which is a myth, of that you use to tell a story. But the real story is about you and turning the base matter, let's go back to Milarepa, taking that base person of materiality in the world and turning them, transforming them through the furnace of the work, the psychological work, transforming that person into gold, transforming the mind into gold.
So all
And
these stories we hear about tantric practices in general have like a sutric sales pitch to the outcome. Not even sales pitch, more like an avoidance, the opposite of a sales pitch. Figure like, okay, you put a sign out there, it's like, don't come in here. This is what we're doing. And then you have a communication there, a message, which is like, okay, so this is a good story to tell people to keep them away from what we're actually doing. And then you have a tantric inner realm where the tantric work goes on, because the first thing that happens when you do any kind of tantric work, it can be the sex, it can be the psychedelics, it can be the psychoanalysis, or anything else for that matter, but these are the more the Western tantras. But when you do tantric work, the first thing you realize is that what's happening here in this room with these select people who've chosen to go through this process together cannot be understood by anybody outside of this context. And then you realize, okay, that's where there has to be a sutric version of it or a sutric representation of it to the outside world, which is more or less like, okay, here's a temple or a monastery. It's a secluded area. It has its own laws and its own rules inside of it. Therefore, we have a door here. And on the door, we have a sign, a warning sign that says, don't go in here unless you're prepared for it. And this kind of It seems like Vajrayana early on caught on to this understanding that there's an inside and outside of the practice. And to really immerse yourself in the inside of the practice, whether you do it in the middle of a big city or whether you do it on a mountain in isolation, doesn't really matter in the sense that the practice has to be done.
Or in the graveyards, which was a popular way of doing it in Tibet.
Well, and the Gelugpa, this divide between, the mountain and the city, and sutra and the aesthetics and the actual hard work. To go back to the where I got pulled in, the Gelugpa monk told me something really amazing that I think points to a bit of the divide in the West between the sutric approach to even Vajrayana and the tantric approach. And he had various people. He was hanging out. I met him in Lower Hay, where all the artists hung out, and he was smoking pot and drinking and chasing girls. And various people that he met there wanted to help him set up a center, and they wanted to go up to one of the fancy neighborhoods and get a fancy house or whatnot. They wanted something nice and respectable for all these respectable people that they were going to bring. And he was like, no, right here in the gutter, in the Lower Hay, with all the riffraff and the drug gangs and the musicians and the artists, and it's a right old holy mess, unholy mess here. And that's exactly where it's needed.
The charnel ground, right? This is
Yes,
an image that's
with
very big in
Milarepa.
Vajrayana, is of the charnel ground. And they have charnel ground practices, actually. And the original charnel ground was a terrifying place with corpses and all that. But we have charnel grounds, in everywhere, in the modern world. They're just places of intense energy and danger, and there's a certain kind of yogi that practices in that kind of context.
It's what I call shamanic territory. So that's exactly because the entire social hierarchy, the rest of society spends all its energy on focused on and trying to climb that. It's completely eradicated here, and you realize that it's exactly the other way around. Actually, there's no hierarchy to begin with. And if there's a hierarchy, it's only the wisdom hierarchy itself. So just that whoever's been at the gutter longer than somebody else and done the practice of the gutter is probably better than the guy who just arrived at the gutter. But the thing is, it's like I always tell people, we wrote in the book, The Body Machines, we wrote about the deck of cards. There were so many different decks of cards 300 years ago, and only one survived. And all the different card games you play, it's the same deck of cards. And four different colors, and then you got the 13 different cards, which is 2 to 12, and then the ace. And here's the point. The ace is both higher than the king and lower than the two. So basically, when you move from Sutra to Tantra, you look at the overall hierarchy from two to the king. You got the ace, could be either below or above.
Yeah.
And because the ace is the exception, the ace is revealing that this is a false hierarchy. There is no hierarchy. And
then when you turn... He has the same card as me. Sorry to interrupt.
Exactly. And you flip the cards around, you realize they all look the same. The point is to learn to teach yourself to flip the cards around. That's reality. Reality is there is no hierarchy. So the social hierarchy created that people spend so much energy on is the first thing you drop when you move into the tantric realm. Wouldn't that be the case?
Yes. And something I wanted to pick up that Tim said is the alchemy metaphor. I don't know if Tim knows this, but the original, according to Tractum, my own teacher, who's very much one of these kind of teachers who does wild things and sleeps with dogs and does bizarre things that nobody can ever understand.
I love him. He's great.
Anyway, he's great. But one of the things he told me was that the original name for Vajrayana is Rasayana, which means path of alchemy. So Vajrayana is fundamentally alchemy. That's what it is. That's what the Vajrayana path is. It's alchemical.
Where does the word alchemy come from? Is it the perception?
This was Indian alchemy is rasas. The rasas are like states of that, like there's a feeling, and in Indian dance there's different movements associated with different states of mind. There's wrathful, angry states, there's peaceful states, there's blissful states, there's these are all these sort of alchemical states of intensity, which are called
when
rasas.
We talk about alchemy, if you go to the etymology of it, you go to Wikipedia and check it out, it's basically a bunch of guys in Europe 300 to 400 years ago who tried to turn lead into gold. That's deception. We know alchemy is much richer than that. We know alchemy is part of the Mithraic orders of Freemasonry and these parallel cults and secret societies and everything we had in Western culture all along. But we can go into that later. But how do you use the word alchemy here, Andrew? I think it's important to define.
Well, as you say, there's the Silk Road. So all of these traditions there. I also heard that in Tibet, we all often think of Tibet as a monoculture, but before the Chinese invasion and all that, there were all kinds of, there was even Christian churches in Lhasa. There was everything was there. So I think the alchemical tradition doesn't just belong to the West. I think it was influenced by Indian migration and that kind of thing. But yes, the metaphor of alchemy, right? The central metaphor is turning lead into gold. My own teacher would say it's turning gold into gold, but that's just kind of a higher understanding of it.
That's the Hegelian version of alchemy.
Hmm.
All right, back to Tim's story. I want to hear more about Tim's story here. Yeah. And how it came about.
Well, I dug into it in Budapest, and where to go with that? I think.
Why did you talk about frustrations? Like, what was your experience doing that? I mean. How was that for you? Like doing 100,000 prostration, what did that do to you? For me, it changed my whole body, for example. Like this is what these practices change. My entire physicality completely changed after doing that. So this is like, these are very strong, powerful practices. They are very hard too. Yeah.
It's hard physically. I screwed up my shoulders, in high school and, swimming. I was a swimmer, and my shoulders were weak because of that. And I actually had to take a break. I had to stop and restart again and just go slower and be patient. But it's interesting with, you know, a lot of it. Well, like my first POA is the death rite, preparing yourself. It's one of the six yogas of Naropa. And I went into it not knowing really anything about it. And it was really interesting. It dug up all kinds of emotions and just, you know, toss you around emotionally, doing that work. And then you come out at the end and in Diamond Way style, in a huge, glorious, rapturous party with beer and dancing and the llama in the middle of it. And
how is it presented to you before you do the ritual? I mean, it's talked about. I mean, you hear about it all the time. So once you're starting doing the other practices and you're preparing for it, and eventually you do this ritual, how is it presented to you before? And how does it surprise you in the middle of the ritual?
Well, Zhuzha just said, come with us. And I jumped in a car and took off for the weekend. And she purposely didn't tell me anything about it. And I'd read, a bit of Vajrayana, mostly. I'd been studying yoga, and I was studying Sanskrit, and I'd read Crazy Wisdom. But I didn't know the six yogas. I didn't know of Nundro or any of that. I didn't know what a POA was. I got there and it was just like, surprise, we're doing a death ritual, and I can't get into or won't get into the details of that, except that you're preparing yourself, your energy, your mind, through a simulated death. Well, you send out. You're sending out your energy. You get a hole in the top of your head.
Yeah, this is a phenomenon that happens to a lot of people that do powwow. They, you know, we can't really explain this scientifically.
Everyone that I saw got it. Either
you get this little hole in the top of your head,
a little hole, or like a rash. Some people who aren't good about sitting still. One guy, he had like four different little disc shaped, you know, spots on the top of his head, and it's powerful. You're doing this. You're doing a group. There was like 3,000 people, all doing these chants, and you're moving your energy, creating a power field with a llama and the rest of the people, and the mandala that you're building in your mind. And you're doing this all day, like three or four sessions, and it's intense, and it's hard to say how it transforms you specifically, except that, you know, over time, through doing these multiple times and doing the Nundro, it changes you. You have phenomena that you experience that can sometimes be startling, unexpected. I wasn't going into this thinking, oh, I'm going to get a hole in my head. If you'd have told me that before, I would have said, you're crazy. And yet, you know, I've done it many times and seen it with many people. And, you know, doing 111,000 diamond mine, you know, when you're at various points, you know, I was, you can become, what do you call it?
Yeah, this is the purification practice that you're speaking of now, where
Yeah,
you
well,
kind of purify your poisons out of you in a psychosomatic and a psychophysical kind of a way. Yeah, could say.
and the mandala offerings, all of them, you can become what's the term? Well, you start becoming really spaced out and entering into kind of a different realm. You're really kind of I had to pull back. I was, if you're expecting me to go to work, you got to be able to like tune in to the real world, and you start getting a little bit out there. I wish I could think of the term, but
Well, it's interesting, like you're describing two things, right? When you have an experience, a shock experience, kind of like, I think the power practices give you a bit of a shock, and then you have to do the work to integrate that in your life, and that's kind of the nundra. So there's this combination of, sudden enlightenment and gradual enlightenment. That's what the Zen people call it.
Why is poa called death ritual? Where does the term come from?
the poa well that's one that's what's the Tibetan? I have it
Ejecting
here.
consciousness at the moment of
Yeah,
death, I think it means. Ejecting
poa,
your consciousness out the top of your head at the moment of death. You can read about it.
the yoga
Okay.
of the transference of consciousness
Yeah.
to a pure Buddha field.
Yeah. So technically, it's like we would describe contemporary language, like you get rid of the self in consciousness, and it's actually consciousness, which is the subconsciousness you move into. That's the way I would describe it. But I'm a big proponent of subconsciousness. I'm not a big fan of consciousness. I think subconsciousness is where things are at in life anyway. So that's the terminology I would use then. But Well,
just I think
Dzogchen
I'm
would be like, yeah, consciousness is an illu is the last illusion. It's a kind of a it's kind of a filter. Like so you're ejecting your consciousness, but because
So this is more like a
this
general
is not an
practice.
ultimate practice, this is a skillful means. This is an important concept in Vajrayana is skillful means. Like you do all these deity practices and things like that, they're skillful means. They're called upaya. And so there's all these psychomagical practices. I think there's 83,000 different tantras, somebody told me once, but they're skillful means. And Pawa
Suggest
is a
that
powerful
consciousness.
kind of skillful means. Yep, you could say pure consciousness, but they would say awareness would be the Buddhist terminology for pure consciousness. Hindus say pure
I agree.
consciousness.
Agree. I, you know what? There is no
Buddhists say
pure. There
awareness
is no pure
usually.
consciousness. If anything is pure, it's subconsciousness, which is
Yeah.
pure. As soon as you go from subconsciousness to consciousness, it's not pure any longer because the self is suddenly added. So that's my point. That's my point. So this
Well,
is different.
I would
I'm
suggest
just
that
asking because I just want to rephrase that why I'm
consciousness.
asking is because if you do death ritual, for example, the Peruvian Chavín tradition is strictly something that priests or monks do, and they do it to be of service to the community. So you basically learn how to die and you learn what death is, and then you return to life and you get angry when you return to life because you realize birth is anger. You don't want to live the first thing you experience. And then you realize you are there, you will live, and you will serve the community. And what it does is that it fosters you into total submission to what's best for the community. Which is the
Well,
point with the death ritual in Peru. It's different in that sense from the Tibetan death ritual, apparently.
the first thing you do in the POA weekend, or however long you're doing it, the first thing that you do is take the Bodhisattva vow that you're dedicating yourself and this action to the betterment of people, starting with yourself. That you have to raise yourself up out of the gutter, not to leave the gutter, not to leave the material world, but to raise others up. And I think I want to say something, but before I do that, consciousness, I think I would suggest is resonance, and that there are levels of resonance, and that when you have for the human mind, different resonances working together coming into harmony is where you arrive at human consciousness versus lower consciousnesses. And that directly relates to what you're doing in these ritual practices, is that you're, you know, 111,000 of anything is going to entrain you to resonate and harmonize with that thinking. And that the deity yoga is that, yeah, where you're once you finish all of these purifications, you then go into guru yoga and deity yoga, where you are seeing yourself as the deity, or Yeshe Kandro, the wisdom Dakini,
or sometimes body, the deity in sexual union with another deity. You know, there's all kinds of different forms of deity yoga. Yeah, some are very ferocious, wrathful. I have a picture, I think it's back here, of the wrathful deities, you know, and I think maybe this one's wrathful too. And then
George A. Chong.
Yes, yeah. There's the wrathful deities, there's the angry deities that you practice, and then there's the beautiful, sensuous women deities that you practice, and then there's all kinds of different practices that you replace your own psychosomatic awareness of you as, you know, Andrew Sweeney or whatever, with deity awareness, which is and develop what you call Vajra pride. It doesn't mean pride in your ordinary ego, but it's pride that you're turning consciousness into divinity, into deity.
And then everything is like 10 or 100 times stronger than you've experienced it before, I guess. That's the whole point, right?
Well, and I guess if you realize it, yes. But it's also another thing that's lots of work. It's not like an acid trip. You do a lot of work to work on these visualizations, so you can keep them in your mind at all times when you're doing things, like when you're in the train or, you know, anywhere. Or, yeah.
Well, and, you know, being there in that place on the train.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to say before, you know, the pointing out about consciousness is that I think the important aspect of Vajrayana versus Theravada and Mahayana is that the goal is not to leave.
Yeah.
The view in Vajrayana is key. That what you said, Andrew, about, you know, not turning shit into gold, lead into gold, and gold into gold,
yeah,
is exactly it. There is a perspective in
do you know this term, the resultant path, Tim?
No.
You start with the result. So you're not trying to get some kind of a result. That's kind of you are and you're not. There's a funny paradox there. But they call Vajrayana the resultant path because it's not like you're going to go through this, you know, climbing up a ladder or something. You're more like coming back to the already existing state of what they would call Buddhist pure awareness or luminosity, emptiness, or all these different
terms. I was just going to ask her about the comparison. So if you don't mind, we can go back to the topic, but I want to know, because a lot of this rhymes with me in Persian philosophy, there's obviously a lot of similarities, and Padmasambhava, I belong to the people who actually, Padmasambhava came from probably contemporary Tajikistan or something like that. Like Bodhidharma started Zen and Shan in China, came from Sogdia. He was an Afghan, he would say today. So a lot of these Indian princes probably never came out of India to begin with. But because I see so many similarities. And this whole thing of throwing yourself back to reality and the gutter, and to be there totally with your humanity and your humaneness, is so aligned with Persian philosophy, with Zoroastrianism. It's exactly the same thing. So how does Vajrayana, since it has this close relation to Persian philosophy, undoubtedly, how does Vajrayana relate to, say, Theravada and Zen? What are your experiences? Because you both obviously tried these different traditions.
Well, I would say from your books and thinking, Bard, the idea of the chief, the priest, and the shaman. The sutra is the law of the chief.
That's
And
good
then you
to
have the priest and Mahayana and the aesthetics of the temple and such. And in both of those, it's about going somewhere else, leaving, becoming a
hmm.
Buddha. And this relates back to what I wanted to say earlier, which is that there is a there are two different views. One, that the world is suffering. The world is not suffering. Suffering happens. And the idea that, you want to go somewhere else. You want to go to heaven or go to the Pure Land. The Pure Land is here. And so
Yeah, I
the
had the same
suffering of it.
thoughts about the Pure Land when there was this discussion about the Pure Land, because Vajrayana does indeed deal with different Pure Lands, but Pure Land, it doesn't mean a place. It's not a place that you go to at all.
It's a view.
It's more like I don't know, a peak state, or I don't know how to explain that, but there's different kind of it practices you go through, and they're not ultimate in themselves. That's why Buddhism combines luminosity with emptiness, right? So whatever you create is also empty. So there's this in the Sutrayanic traditions up to Mahayana, the ultimate view is emptiness. But Vajrayana is radical because it brings in form and rad to emptiness. It brings in luminosity, form, all this to emptiness. So it's not that the world's an illusion that you have to leave. It's not a path of renunciation. However, there's, except it's maybe a renunciation of your own idiot,
Well,
self.
it's the same thing in Japan, because you've got Pure Land Buddhism in Japan and Taiwan, which is like a popular pop Buddhism. Essentially, it has to do the afterlife or whatever. And then you go and stay in a Zen monastery, and the first thing they tell you is that there's no reincarnation going on here, because there's nothing there to reincarnate. What reincarnates are the archetypes. So what happens is that the Sangha is being reborn. The Sangha is being reborn. Your job is to find out through your practice what kind of archetype you are, so you can submit to and serve the Sangha. That's all there's to it. So you completely lose interest in going anywhere else, which is the whole point of spiritual practice. You stay where you are and you work from what you have, and you basically just unfolding, you're negating, you're taking away stuff. The true self, whatever you want to call it, but the goal of the journey is to get to a certain state of things where you see, oh, I can see the world from so many different perspectives. And the whole point of that, I negated all the things, I've taken away the things that were standing in the way. The curtains are gone, and I can see things more clearly. And that was the point with the whole exercise.
But you still remain always within the view of sutra as well, like, because you always have to, as Tim was saying, you always have to take refuge. So to be a Buddhist officially, you take refuge in the Buddha, you take the Bodhisattva vow, you do these formal things, and you promise to practice wisdom and compassion. Right, this is sutra, and then once you have a basis in that, then
Listen, Andrew,
you can go
if
into
I
the
would ignore the
tantra.
sutra, there wouldn't be any coffee in this cup. So the sutra is everyday life everywhere. And that's why you learn to respect and love the people who live a completely sutric life if they choose to do so. What I learned as a Zoroastrian in India was to never look down on the Hindus, because the Zoroastrians do regard themselves as this elite religion of really well-educated people, but they never look down on anybody. It's just a choice. You go through the process, you do the work, you get educated, you become a successful Zoroastrian. But the attitude is that if I would walk around with my nose up in the air, they would just go, listen, anybody who loves their children, bow down to them, submit to them right away. Anybody who loves their children, bow down and submit to it. You're nothing more than human in any state you go to. It's just that your curiosity and your willingness to serve and submit is actually what drives you to these practices. And that's why suddenly there's that door called Tantra, which unfortunately to me, Christianity and Islam is basically called sin. which obviously then just creates this pressure cooker of desire towards what's sinful, which is, of course, the history of Christianity and Islam. It's full of these, you know, constant explosions of people who just can't stand being in pressure cooker any longer. Whereas in Eastern philosophy, you constantly have a door that says Tantra. It's located there. It's there. If you must go there, you can apply and see if you're ready to go into that realm. But the tantric realm is there to be added to the sutric, but never, ever compromise on the sutric.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember going to the museum, the Ghibli Museum in Paris, and there was an exhibition of all the Buddhist statues. And up to a certain point, there was all these wrathful deities and, dakinis and sexual union and all these cool, you know, they'd be cool enough to be a manga, you know, comic today or whatever. And then suddenly the Islamic, in the 12th century, they wiped out everything. And then all you have left of Buddhism is very pure, peaceful, Kuan Yin's and Zen things. And they completely pushed out Tantra because Tantra was too scary for the mainstream. And even in Sri Lanka right now, so, you know, Buddhists are pretty uptight as well, you know, not just Christians. In Sri Lanka, it's illegal to have a Yab-Yung image like I have behind me. There, it's like that's illegal because it's considered to be some perversion of the purity. Yeah, so it's
the same thing happened to Zoroastrianism when it was exposed to Islam in Iran and Central Asia. It was cleaned up, cleansed. Suddenly the fire temples were minimalized and became minimalist in their architecture and whatever. And of course, rich traditions like Homa, Zoroastrianism being the only world religion that embraces psychedelics, Homa had to be rediscovered. Only the last 30 years has that process started when Zoroastrians came to the West, and also Zoroastrians in India became a word. Or the fact they were basically running modern India. And then suddenly the self-esteem came into the picture, and a lot of converts like me came along, scholars came along and said, listen, this is how rich this religion is. And by the way, we should retake Sufism because the Muslims haven't treated the Sufis very well and actually they come from us. Sufism originally is Buddhist and Zoroastrian. It's a mix of Buddhism and Zoroastrianism. It was developed in Central Asia originally. That's where it comes from. That's a Sufi tradition, way, way older than Islam itself. And it's so fantastic to see these doors being opened now, because Zoroastrianism and Buddhism obviously were not as cleansed and as pure looking as to be portrayed as. That's just been influenced from Islamic Christianity. No, they're explosive. The rich traditions too. Yeah.
Yeah, and there were never like a mono. One of the things my own teacher does, Tractum, is try to go back before even Tibetan Buddhism. Because Tibetan Buddhism did become a kind of a monoculture. It became a kind of a tyranny, whereas the roots in India, again, was when it was more connected with the Silk Road, there wasn't such a strict definition. Okay, this is the Buddhist religion, this is the Hindu religion, this is Zoroastrianism, this is whatever, Gnosticism.
Those divisions were made by scholars in Europe in the 19th century.
Yeah, and so what we call religion today is
Europeans were eager to put ideologies out there and say, ism, any ism you got out there, you can be pretty sure that has never existed before 19th century Europe. There has never been any isms anywhere. There were just spiritual schools, period.
There were schools. So,
yes.
So Tim, for example, practices in the Karma Kagyu school, of Vajrayana Buddhism. I wouldn't even say Tibetan Buddhism because I don't think that's the right term. I think it's Vajrayana Buddhism. And my school was called the Nyingmapa. And they were two very close traditions. They're known for, let's say, a bit of radicality and lots of practice. They're called the practice lineages. Whereas the Gelupas and the Dalai Lama, those guys were much more scholarly and intellectual, and they debated a lot. But they didn't necessarily do the wild yogic types of practices. Would you agree with that, Tim?
Yeah, and that's, where Vajrayana becomes bourgeois, and you have that in the West as well. There was early on in various locales when Diamond Way was coming forward, there was a bit of a split between the bourgeois who liked the aesthetics and meditating and getting a blessing from the Lama, and who didn't want to do the practice.
So, like if a Marxist here, we could just remind anybody who watches this conversation that when you move from working class to middle class, it gets boring. The middle
that's
class
true.
kill everything. So
Well,
anything that's working class has a life to it. But when anything moves from working class to middle class, it gets killed on the way, and it's just dead when it comes
one
out
of
the
the
other end.
strengths of Lamaola is he went to Poland, right? He went to like Eastern Europe, and he just got the working class, whereas many of the other lamas from Tibet went to the U.S. and they got the California, there's this practice in Tibetan Buddhism where you try to tame a deity, and so they went to Hollywood, and found Hollywood people and converted them to Tibetan Buddhism. But then, as Tim says, like I agree fully. There's this sort of ugly tradition of bourgeois, of Vajrayana, which is often it's like a fashion sometimes. Like people wear like Tibetan things, and it's kind of ugly.
Well, and
Yeah.
it's, Vajrayana too, and specifically the work and the original practices, the six yogas of Naropa, this is hardcore magic.
Yeah, also,
You
yeah.
know, and there's there you know, it's not necessarily comfortable. Like we said, the practices are hard. But then, invoking, Black Coat, the demon master, and the
It's just interesting. That's the Malakala, right? I never heard that translation of the Malakala,
yeah.
but yeah, cool.
Going into dream yoga, doing the poas, the deity yogas, the viewing yourself as a female consort of a Buddha. This is not middle class,
And then there's actual karma yoga, which are the sexual practices where people have consorts and whatnot. And it's kind of hard maybe transplant that to America, how they look at that, because I think we have a very different view of that sort of thing.
It's like
Yeah, well,
once you move to the middle classes, you can't help yourself but turn something into shopping. Yeah, that's what it is. Then it becomes
Trogdon
shopping.
Trungpa called that spiritual materialism. He said he was like, that's what's going to happen in America, spiritual materialism. It's going to get really fucking ugly. He said that right away, and it sure did. But yeah, I was going to ask Tim about the Diamond Sangha, because I guess what's different about his Sangha and mine is I'm from a very small Sangha. There's very few people in my Sangha, so everybody has a kind of a relationship to the teacher, and I think it's designed that way. And what's remarkable about Lama Ole is how much of a rock star he was able to be, as let's say a, and yet still be very edgy and kind of offend people, and in Vajrayana is an
And
offense to the ego,
purposely.
right? Vajrayana is designed as an offense to the ego, so it's not. I guess maybe if he was around today, that he couldn't be on television, he couldn't be on internet much. I don't know. I don't know how he does it, actually.
Oh, he would get canceled nowadays.
Oh yeah.
I mean, he's older now. Ahana died years back of cancer, and Lamaole's position is changing. We're growing as a sangha into something else. When he passes on, well, what happens then? And there's a bit of a there's a well, people get older and get more settled. And I think the Sangha has done that a bit, but generally anarchistic in that each of the sanghas are in charge of their path. There's no one way, and Ole set this up on purpose that it not become a monolithic monastery,
That's always the case with Eastern spirituality. I always remind people that there's no Rome and no Mecca in the East.
There's a
Because, yeah,
decentralized
because the whole idea
system
that
in a way,
religion is a dogma and that it's a set of teachings and these teachings must be followed is because these are faiths where having the proper faith, having the right belief is the key to get to heaven. This is what Christianity and Islam are both driven by. And it's completely alien to Eastern philosophy for the simple reason that these are just practices. And the more decentralized these practices are, the less you run the risk of having a center of somebody running from the center. So the only equivalent you get of something like that in Eastern culture would be like something like Confucianism. But Confucianism is really not about spiritual practice, about holding a society together. It's just basically the Eastern Platonism. It's basically an idea of how you run a society together, hold it together without it falling apart. So this is the Chinese idea of Confucianism, which is exactly why Confucianism and Taoism operate completely in parallel. Because Taoism is completely decentralized. It doesn't have a Rome. It doesn't have a Mecca. You go to a spiritual center. You have a certain teacher. You learn a certain tradition or a certain lineage, and you get involved with that. And when you convert to that specific tradition. And this makes perfect sense. This is exactly what I think of the most important point in this conversation. There was an Andrew pointed out that Tibet was not a monoculture originally at all. You know, it was just Lhasa before the Chinese invasion in 1958 was a multicultural. It was just like it was a trading culture. Like everything else along the Silk Road, it was a trading culture. And all of Central Asia have been trading cultures until Islam came along and then fostered this idea of the center, which was Mecca, which was far away. And if you could afford it, you could go to Mecca. And did you get a social status because you've done the Hajj? That's exactly how it operated. So you literally had to do pilgrimage to prove that you believed in the right dogma. But these are dogmatic religions, and we inherited political ideology in the West as well from having dogmatic religions, thinking that everybody else goes for the dogma. And then you realize when you live in Eastern cultures that they don't have dogma and they don't care. Doesn't
I
make any
like
sense.
the my own teacher's name, Traktam Kepa, which means it means vampire, blood drinking vampire, something like that in Tibetan. So the Tibetans laugh at him when he translates his name. And his previous incarnation, because there's a lineage, right, of incarnations, was named Dokhenze. And Dokhenze lived in eastern Tibet and went around with a gun into monasteries, shooting in the air and taking a shit and leaving, and he and had 1,000 consorts, including his sister. So this is the lore of these crazy wisdom teachers in the East, and he's beloved, like in Eastern Tibet, he's like he's considered, you know, the greatest guy, and there's hundreds of stories in him, so you could see how much humor there is in the religion, you know. And I think this is, you know, as you said, joy and humor. You know, Lamales, they have these wild parties. There's a feast practice in all of the Vajrayana lineages. There's dancing is like, so in a monastery, it's very interesting because I lived in a Sutric monastery, which was very strict and followed the Vinaya, and the Vinaya is rules like you know, no sex, no jewelry, no dancing, you know, hundreds of rules. And then next door was the Vajrayana place, and in the Vajrayana place there were skulls and corpses of animals on the ground and huge murals of copulating deities, and the contrast was right there, the sutric and the tantric.
And
So
the closest we have in the West is like Rumi and Hafez and Sufism. That's the closest we have. And
yeah.
that's like a tenth of the power of these guys in China and India and Tibet, right?
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Well, the whole idea of yabhyum, of the divine union, the consorts, I think is very important, and goes back to, you know, is about here, about now, about your activity, and that you are in union with everything. There's not a divide as in sutra. Thus the, you know, no need, you know, for a fancy center, do it, you know, do it in the gutter.
So this is important. So there's a dualism and a modism at play here, but it's not dualism in the sense like dogmatic dualism, but rather it's like in sutra, there's clearly a sutra and there's a tantra, and tantra is not here, right?
Well, the dualism...
And tantra is much more inclusive in the sense that when you go into the tantra ground, the sutra is already given, and tantra is like added on the sutra. So tantra is like the two together.
They say not two and not one, which is not... So if you look at the tantric deities, they're together. They're not one. In other words, they're not a mass, an indistinguishable mass from each other. They're not two because they're one, you know? So they're not two and they're not one. This is the kind of the formulation.
It's a relationship.
Yeah. So it is it's ultimately like you would say, Alexander, I think you would say monist, you know, they would usually say non-dual. But it's ultimately non-dual, but there's a duality within the non-duality.
But you can have
which is just love,
like,
which
wait,
is
wait,
just
wait,
like
wait,
like
wait,
sex
wait,
and love.
Wait, wait,
and,
wait, yeah. Right? Duality and dualism are totally different things. Duality just means difference. That you can have as much difference as you like within the modest universe. The problem is that people mistake duality for dualism. That's exactly what I pointed out. Mm-hmm. That with the sutra, there's the exclusion. There's
Got
sutra,
it.
Period. This makes society work. It's like the minimal function of what things work. So this is like operating like everyday reality must work. This
yeah,
is
and
sutra.
Life is suffering, so you got to get the fuck out, you know,
whatever,
by
yeah.
doing
but,
these skillful
okay.
means.
So to me, Christianity and Islam went for the sutra and for the sutra only. Whenever Christians or Muslims say, no, we have a tantric practice, I'm just like, I'm laughing my head off. No, you do not. You do not endorse like having 1,000 mistresses. No, you do not. So forget about that. It's just ridiculous to make such claims. And this is why the richness of Eastern spirituality is precisely to have this whole wide perspective of life in it. And this is all spiritual. And you're in the gutter and it's spiritual. I mean, if you're a sex worker, for God's sake, go to the East and become, endorse yourself in Eastern spirituality before you go into sex work. And then you realize what a dakini is. It's just like, it's ridiculous to try to come from out of post-Christian Europe or America and turn into something like sex work and end up in some fucking woke camp doing some kind of political, ideological struggle for your rights to be existing. It's just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. If you are shamanic, don't go for the dogma. Just say, I'm not doing dogma, period. Because in the shamanic realm, you don't do dogma. Dogma is a way to control and put hierarchy into the sutra.
And to take that further, you know, tantra to weave together, that's Vajrayana. You have your sutra, of course, your Mahayana pledge of the Bodhisattva to work for others. You have your death rite. You have your dream yoga. You have your clear light, the yoga of Bardo, the illusory body, building stupas, building a sangha, building relationships, the karma yoga, the yoga of sex, every aspect, nothing is left out. No one is left out.
That's exactly what tantric means.
Yeah, that is what tantric means. Yeah, that's agreed. Yeah, the non-rejection principle of non-rejection. Somebody,
guys, I could talk to you guys like forever, but not to make it too long and closing it up in say the next 50 minutes. I really want to see the connection between Vajrayana and Gurdjieff because you both have a personal relationship to Gurdjieff, and with you, Tim, apparently your relationship to Gurdjieff and his ideas are even. They go even way back. What were you 5 years old when you started doing Gurdjieff or what? And how does Gurdjieff connect to tantric Buddhism for you? Where's the connection?
Doing the work, uncovering yourself. You know, we have all these layers, all these, you know, ideas that are entrained upon us by society. And so it's It's doing the work, and facing yourself and transforming and being open to change, to a new perspective, to a new view, not being closed, not being a stone, but a clear diamond of, the letting the light, enter into you, pass through you,
So
but then
we have this diplomatic term, diamond way, but actually it means diamond phallus, if anything, Bharayana. Bhadrajana.
yeah,
Well,
well,
Vajra is a phallus. It's a diamond phallus. And it yes,
also
diamond
doesn't mean
phallus.
diamond. It means diamantine, which is harder than a diamond. It's
Yeah.
like so it's yes,
Like substance, like the real substance, like
yeah, the hardest
the
sub, the
hardest
hardest,
possible substance. Yeah, like
shiniest,
core, hardcore.
brightest
Like, yes.
core
Yeah.
substance,
Yeah, that
which
makes
is
sense.
the atomic heart of, something like that. And we could talk more about Gurdjieff, perhaps another time, but the one thing different from Gurdjieff that I know is the outcome, what the work and the different practices can do for you. And I think that's, it you have to talk about
Result.
the result, the bliss. When I was speaking earlier about, what was going on in the process of entering the Diamond Way and going through the practices, becoming just utterly just full, drenched in bliss, just unable to do anything but laugh, and just walking. I had times where I was just meditating so much all the time. I'd be walking along and practically just fall over. I had times where I was literally just ready to just fall down in a puddle of joy, of just completely unable to not deal with the world, but be a proper citizen of the world, and not get thrown into the insane asylum, laughing your
But
head.
that's the point. That's the point with the dialectical turn here is that you're not a hippie tripping or anything like that at all. What happens is that the world is thrown at you when you're born. The world is thrown at you basically, and the sutric growing up, getting an education, becoming a member of society, submitting and serving your community, the sangha. In your case, in my case, is the anjuman. Is the highest honor you could possibly do. And all of that is a sutric path you need to walk, and then. After you are there, you're comfortable there, you're fine with that, you've achieved that, you are that social being, then you can start looking at everything else in the world. And
You
that's
don't
what,
start with
and
bliss
all of that
because.
falls back into your life again. But this time around, you stand solidly and you have this solid platform. You're not a newborn little unprotected baby. You're a grown-up, you stand solidly, and you can take on these things. And that's exactly what your master, in his crazy wisdom, or her crazy wisdom for that matter, has basically told you that. All of these things are going to fly at you, basically, and be prepared for them. Now it's coming, but you're prepared. You're ready for it. You
You
can
have to do
handle
a
it.
lot of preparation. In fact, the Nundro is called the preliminaries. It's all preparation. So you do lots of preparation in Vajrayana. And then the And it
way they say transformation through bliss, being in this. So there, that's bliss is not, it isn't, you're right to say, it's not some kind of hippie childish bliss of going back into the womb. I mean, that could be part of it, but there's also an intelligence That's still operating.
We use the term "be infinite now" at our work because I think it spots is much better than the word "bliss." But bliss is fine. Well, I'm fine with using the term. But the infinite now, because it's a contradiction, and I think the only way to describe these states is through contradiction, because otherwise people misunderstand them. The infinite now means it contradicts itself. Great, that's exactly the point. It cannot be worded.
But just back to Gurdjieff, maybe his earlier teachings. You know, he says he wrote three series of books. The first book was to destroy all the mental constructs and ideas that people had about reality. You know, because he felt that, you know, when he was writing, that everything was so unbelievably wrong and corrupt. So he wanted to deconstruct everything. That's like what he said in his first series of books. The second series of books is Meetings with Remarkable Men, where you're supposed to meet a teacher. You know, so you've done all the work, then you meet the teacher. And the third part is, like he said, it's a big unknown, and it's only for some people. And perhaps that's the tantra of Gurdjieff, but we don't know, because a lot of people just follow Ouspensky's teachings of you know, conscious suffering all the time. And they've reified the teachings and made it a sort of a religion. But Gurdjieff was ruthless in trying to root that kind of reification out, but he couldn't do it, you know.
This is what crazy wisdom does. So the problem is that Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, obviously, I agree with you totally. Ouspensky, for all his efforts to try to mimic his master, only did mimicry and then taught everything as mimicry. So the problem with dogmatic religions, basically, here's the formula, here's what you're supposed to do. If you do exactly this, if you repeat this and you mimic this, then God will be happy with you. You get a kiss from God and you're fine. Like, it's like treating you as a child. I mean, no kidding. Islam and Christianity pride themselves in calling their followers the children of God. Wasn't the point of being the adults of God? You know, and this is Eastern spirituality, radically different from Western spirituality, in the sense that in Eastern spirituality, you are the adult of God. You are a God. You are a God. You are co-creating the world. That's exactly the point. And here's the thing, why crazy wisdom is so fundamental here when you get to that point, is that crazy wisdom is basically a mechanism your teacher turns on so you can't copy them. That's the point. You can't. They behave in such a way it cannot be copied, and precisely because it cannot be copied, it can't be copied. You have to find yourself in your own behaviors, in your own practice, because you're no longer mimicking master. Mm-hmm. And that was the whole point. That's the end point. If you can get there, I think Gurdjieff's fourth way is there. I think it's, if you go beyond the Hegel's absolute into spiritual realm, you would end up there too. And I think it's certainly with tantric practice and tantric Buddhism comes to the same point.
It's important to add that it's. Tantra and Vajrayana is experiential. And as you were saying, you know, it's not to be the children of God, but the adult of God, right? Is the experiential path.
Or the deity. And the deity is perception.
It's not about faith. It's not about faith in something outside you. It's about experiencing. And taking it in yourself, being the Buddha, not having faith in the Buddha, but acting as a Buddha, embodying the bliss, the power, and the fearlessness of the Buddha. And these are all, those three are very prominent in the teachings of Lama Ole. We have t-shirts of that, fearlessness, power. Joy, bliss. These are experiential, worldly things.
And you get out of the feudalism of these dogmatic religions where you put a God at the top of a hierarchy, so you could have a hierarchy all the way down.
Yeah.
And there is no God there. There's no God there in any of the Eastern spiritualities. You can just, forget it.
But Tibetan had an extremely Confucianist culture of, you know, they were obsessed with hierarchy at a certain point. And even now, if you see a Lama, they'll lie down on the floor and start kissing the feet of this. But they don't really have a reason to. It's just culture, right? So the good thing about Western Buddhism, actually, you know, there's a lot of bad things we could say about Western Buddhism, is it cast off that whole Confucianist hierarchy culture, and people were very much more direct you know, like La Mole was very direct, and Shogam Trimba was very direct about these things with his students. And so yes, the collapse of the hierarchy so that there could be something more authentic, like a real hierarchy. In other words, the teacher is definitely, you know, the master, but it's an authentic relationship. It's not a sycophantic.
Well, Buddhism did its job. It did one thing beautifully that actually is the great thing with Christianity and Islam as well, Zoroastrianism too, is that all those four religions actually got rid of the caste system. So in a sense, they did get rid of social hierarchy. But you still live in a feudalist society if you get rid of the caste system. And that means there's a lot of hierarchy going on, the stuff they do with the religion itself. So actually honoring the Lama is probably because you have to honor the king. And if you have to honor the king, you might as well honor the priest as much, you know, because you actually trust the priest more than you ever trust the king. The priest is much more closer to you, much more local with you, and doesn't rule over you the way the king does, because the king can actually tell you to go out and kill in a war for the sake of the king, which the priest will not do. So I think to understand these cultures fully, if you go to Thailand and you're Theravada, forest monk, or whatever you want to be, you realize that Thailand is incredibly, very, very strong, strict social hierarchy. Yeah. It's still nothing compared to a caste system. A caste system, a formal caste system like India had, is so fucking intense. You're born into something like woke people do today. Like if you're a Sam and you're born in Northern Sweden, you have to raise reindeer if you're 16th Sam or something like that. Woke culture today is the return of the caste system. That's how horrible it is. And Asia tried its best to get rid of it. The Buddhists were eventually forced out of India because they were so successful getting rid of the caste system that in the 4th century, they were forced out of India. And then, of course, they spread to Tibet, took a lot of their wealth and rich culture with them. And, of course, they spread on to China, Mongolia, Japan eventually, and down to Southeast Asia. And they stayed in Sri Lanka. So that's why you have those different Buddhist realms all over the Asian map, except for India. But what Buddhism fought was the caste system. So it should be credited, together with Christianity, Islam, and Zoroastrianism, for being these religions that actually fought against strict formal social hierarchies. Yes.
And the Vajra master, like when I met my own teacher, you know, I met him in Hamburg, and we went to this kind of bourgeois Buddhist center that he was invited to teach in. And he arrived there with like crazy hair, like, you know, practically wearing pajamas, kind of overweight, smoking a cigar. And he started to tell, you know, vulgar, dirty jokes. And then all the spiritual people like left. And then the authentic people were left.
They couldn't stand the crazy wisdom. They couldn't stand
it. I was just in love with the guy right away. That's what the relationship with the teacher should be. But then, you know, then he could teach once he had kicked all the phony spiritual types out of the center and insulted the hierarchy of the actual center and you know, done everything in his power to get rid of all spiritual air, you know, phony spiritualism. And then then he could teach Vajrayana. Lama Ole was good at that too.
Lama Ole,
he was good at that as well.
I have a quote for you from another modern master, Alejandro Jodorowsky, from the end of Holy Mountain.
Yeah.
Goodbye to the Holy Mountain. Real life awaits us.